Well, thank you, Club 12. It's an honor to be here. It's always a privilege to address a group of Alcoholics Anonymous for a variety of reasons. My name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic. And I was marveling at the similarities and yet the differences of different venues. I have not traveled a lot with Alcoholics Anonymous, although I have been in a lot of meetings and a lot of places. I didn't travel as a result of AA, but recently the Spirit's moving and directions, and I don't know, probably 6 months ago, I had a fellow show up at a meeting I've been doing for a decade or more in Phoenix, where we try and help people find their experience in our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And this guy had been sitting in a basement in a church in Edmonton, Canada, for the last 4 years listening to a 2009 recording of me at that meeting. And I'm thinking, who would do that? You know what I mean? And anyway, he asked if I would mind coming up, this group of men that meets on Saturday morning at this church in Edmonton, been listening to the same recordings for all these years, and would I come up and talk to them? They wanted me to come share the Spirit with them, and what do you say to that? It was flabbergasting to me, because for one thing, the meeting that I do, the guy who came into AA doesn't do anything for 10 years other than drink. And to show up and try and help people grow all those years, the idea that somebody as far away as Edmonton was even hearing it was amazing. But anyway, we got to go do that. And in about the same window, I found out my friend Steve asked if I'd come down here and share your celebration with you. And so I know the Spirit's moving, and the Spirit moves in a mighty way. And I hope I don't offend anybody, but I am a believer in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Love the fellowship, but I don't think the fellowship's the program. I'm a firm believer in this power we come to believe in. We come to believe in a tangible power. And when I get up here and tell you the story of what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now, it is the story of God through me. It had nothing to do with me, because powerless is not a theory. It was an experience. So all I can tell you for sure is that it's nice to be here. Now, what you don't do very quickly, I came to AA when I was about 27 years old, and as you can see, I've matured. And one of the things that you don't really catch along the way is it seems like everyone else gets older and you don't, and then one day you realize, no, I really have slowed down. As we were going into Canada and past customs, they flagged Denise and I off to the side. I thought, well, I wonder what she's got us into. And pretty soon they dismissed her, and it was me they wanted to talk to. And I could see the panic in her eyes, and I didn't want to show anyone else the panic in mine. Anyway, the guy looks at me and he goes, so this arrest you had 30 years ago, you had any trouble since that? And I immediately go right to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm like, why? What'd you hear? I ain't copping to nothing until you tell me what you got. But anyway, he let me go, and then he thanked me for coming in. Anyway, we had gone all the way to Edmonton, and we didn't know where we were staying. I mean, it's typical drunk on a lark, right? Didn't know where we were staying. We knew some guy was picking us up at the airport. We didn't even know where we were going to speak. So when they start asking me questions, I don't know where I'm going. Don't know where I'm staying. No, I got nothing to declare. So I will tell you, even though the flight was delayed, this was an easier trip, because I didn't have to go through customs. To tell this story, this power, first of all, I am a firm believer that when I tell this story, I'm telling you about this power that we call God in recovery, and this God is the subject of my experience, not the object of my belief. I drank myself into this empty shell of a guy. I read in Bill's story his description of Ebby, and Ebby describing his meeting to Bill, and he says that he was on a scrap heap, and that he had been raised from this scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he'd ever known. And I'd never really thought of that metaphorically, but that's really what it was with me. I was in the scrap heap, and I was part of the scrap. I know we talk about low bottoms and high bottoms. All I know is that I was not raised to be what I ended up. And I will tell you, I've met people in the rooms that have come from, you know, destitute lives, and so you can almost see it if you were in a psychological point of view, you know, how people, if you believe that this is a family thing versus a heredity rather than whatever, you know, all the arguments that I've heard over the years. And hell, I don't want to get in any of those arguments, but I'll tell you, I wasn't raised in destitute. I was raised in a, you know, upwardly mobile middle-class family, kind of the political class. They've been in the leadership in the state of Arizona. My grandfather was a senator. My other grandfather was a sheriff. I mean, there was lots of opportunities provided for me, and I availed myself of those opportunities. But there was always this expectation when I grew up like that, that there was, you know, that I was going to go on to higher learning, and I was going to do something important. And so I egoically believed that I was going to do something important, but somewhere within me I had doubts. And so I did all those things. I went and got college educated. I even had an opportunity, interestingly enough, and you guys down here in Texas can probably appreciate an old Arizona boy. I got sent to Cambridge in the UK to go to school for a period of time. And you can't possibly be more out of place than an Arizona boy in Cambridge. And the thing was, at that time, the television show Dallas was a big deal. And so they assumed when they met you, you were either from Texas or New York. If they didn't hear the New York accent, you had to be from Texas. And I don't know whether that was true. I you know, we're just a little bit the other way. But anyway, I got to go to school there, got a formal education, came back. What it all really did for me is it got me accelerated on an expense account to some high-flying carousing. I ran around the country and I drank, and I never thought there was going to be an end to it. And eventually, I was the only one who thought there was never going to be an end to it. And it never, you know, the story never ends well for those of us on that trajectory. So eventually, at this ripe old age of 27, I end up in detox and some of those things. And by that time, some of you guys that have been around, this is the 68th anniversary, some of you have been around a long time, you were here before alcoholism was a medical diagnosis. And I thank God you guys are here and still alive to help pass on the real message of AA rather than the one that came afterwards. And I'm not mad at the treatment center professionals. I'm sure they did the very best they could. But I'll tell you two stories of AA recovery. The one where I came through the treatment center and I came out with my trigger list. And I was told what meetings to do and what things, you know, those things that I can do to stay sober. And all those things worked fine for a while. They told me to, you know, if you want a drink, why, you know, play the tape, son. Think it through. And I suppose the memory of suffering will prevent some people from doing things. But I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I read a book that some old drunks wrote, and they said that there are certain times that I'm without defense, that the memory of suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago, I cannot bring it to consciousness. Well, I didn't know that then, so I just did what they told me to do, and I didn't really internalize the message they were giving me. And so somewhere around 10 years of sobriety, I now do own this construction company. I'm operating in about 13 states. I'm licensed in a bunch more, and I'm flying all around the country, sometimes even in private planes, which, quite frankly, I miss that little perk. But I was in it pretty serious by that time, and I didn't really feel like I fit in anywhere. You know, I'm in this little mining town where the business was, and I finally figured out that I didn't like going to the AA groups anymore because all they wanted was something from me. I didn't know that my ego was kind of crowding what little bit of God I'd been introduced to out. And so please don't take this as a blaming story. It's just what happened to me. All of those therapeutic tools worked until they didn't. But what did happen is eventually they didn't. Eventually I got that promise that I could not bring to consciousness with sufficient force the memory of suffering even a week or a month ago. I was out without defense against first drink. So I'm a contractor in the industrial mechanical field. I had hundreds of people working for me over a number of states. So I am a professional negotiator. And to tell you the appalling lack of perspective I suffered from, I wandered into a bar in a little dump in Globe, Arizona, and I traded my company, my planes, my cars, my families for a drink. You'd think a professional negotiator would have got more. But I took a drink, and this guy who's not only college educated in the States, but then educated in a number of fields that are no longer valid in Cambridge, England. When I say that, it was prior to the Euro, and now that Brexit's occurred, my skill set may be needed again, although I don't... I was schooled in currency management, geopolitical strategy. Those of you who are old enough to remember when every country had a currency, sometimes you made money on the product and sometimes you made money on the exchange. And but anyway, I digress. So there I am drinking away my life in Globe, Arizona, and I'm still got a lot of money. When you've got a lot of money, it takes a while to drink it away. And ultimately what happened is this very educated fellow, this guy who thought that this can't happen to him, it was happening to him. And I went from that place to living on the streets of Phoenix, Arizona, a homeless man. Now, I don't know if any of you have taken yours to homelessness, but I can tell you from where I came from my socioeconomic background, I was not equipped for homelessness. And it was... It's a stark contrast to what I thought was going to happen. And I could remember all the guys, I've aged to the point that I am one of those guys I used to watch that would just knowingly nod when I was shouting wisdoms through an AA microphone. But when they warn about the things that can happen, the things that will happen, the yets and all those things, I can tell you that I don't know what else can happen, but I can tell you that an education and a lot of money and a lot of powerful people rooting for me, and I still was this homeless man on the streets of Phoenix, Arizona, and I didn't believe for a minute that I could ever get out of that, nor at times did I mean, if you asked me, I told you I didn't want to. I figured out somewhere along the way that if I didn't try again, I couldn't fail again. And what I'm trying to describe to people who may not know the experience, but utter hopelessness. Utter hopelessness. So I started in this endless cycle of going to rooms, showing up at the homeless shelter. I had a basket of 24-hour chips that I'd gathered. I don't know if any of you ever been to a meeting in a homeless shelter, but the delusion is palpable. And you're everybody wants something, man, because you got nothing, right? So if you're handing out chips, it don't matter. We're taking it. So I had this basket full of 24-hour chips because I kept, quite frankly, I had an old AA tell me a long time ago, he's still around, but he was watching me bounce, and he came up to me and he says, "Joe, I noticed that you keep standing up under 30 days. I said, "Yes, sir. I could get any recognition I can take, And he goes, "Well, it may be the only thing you're doing right." He said, "If you could hold on to that, just shred of humility." He said, "I don't care if you ever stand up again after you get beyond 30 days, but until you get 30 days, you just keep standing up." So I didn't have much to bring to consciousness, but I always had that little piece of advice. So I kept gathering up these chips, and I had an old fella come up to me one time, and he said to me, "Hey, are you ever going to quit standing up under 30 days?" I said, "Not if I keep drinking by day 29. Always remembered that fellow, not fondly. But the fact of the matter was that I don't really much give a hoot about how long I've been abstinent from alcohol anymore or anyone else. I don't think that separates me from anybody by one iota. What I do know is that when I finally got tore up enough, I went through a period of time where I just couldn't stop. I either got locked up or chained up or carried out on a gurney. I was in a coma one time for about 11 days as a result of alcohol overdose combined with a bunch of other things I was doing, and I was in a car in Phoenix, Arizona in August. If any of you pass out in this country in a car, you ought to be dead, not revived. But anyway, they got me out. They put me back together. I had to be retrained to eat, to feed myself, to walk. And to tell you the depth of the disease, what the experience of powerlessness was for me, was that all I could think about while they're training me again through therapy to feed myself and walk was that if they'll let me go out and smoke, I can get over to that 7-Eleven and get a beer.
Yep.
And I'd say that, I'd say this to a room like this and go, yeah, me too. But, you know, you say that in normal circles, they don't get it. You know what I mean? They can't. And I did. They finally got me to where I could walk out, and off I went with my butt hanging out of that gown over to the 7-Eleven. Security picked me up on the way back, but not before I finished the beer. It was like an accomplishment. And I don't know what else happened, but I don't want to spend a lot of time in the mess only to tell you I was absolutely hopeless, and I went to yet another treatment. And finally, I'm sitting in this treatment facility, and I had some other issues, so I had this opiate thing. Kind of Bill talks about it. So I had opiate withdrawal, I had alcohol withdrawal, I'm in delirium tremens, I got all this crap going on, and I'm sitting in yet another treatment facility, and interestingly enough, another fella from Texas comes strolling into this treatment facility, and he started talking. I'd been to 1,000 meetings, 10,000 meetings, who knows, lots of years of meeting. And this guy was talking about a book I'd seen 1,000 times, and mine was all colored up with colors, but he was talking about an experience out of that book that I had never, ever experienced. And I didn't know much at that point, but I knew if I could stop that guy before he left, if he would just tell me what he knew, if he would show me what he knew, that I had a shot. And I didn't believe I had a shot for years. And he started going through this book, and it was like there was no one else in the room. But he started introducing me to not some conceptual, not some God of my understanding, but a God of my experience, a power to come to believe in, that expressed itself as a tangible power, a power greater than me, a power to afford me the ability to be kinder than I felt like being, a power that gave me the power to love the unlovely, to tolerate the intolerable, to move out beyond the grip of the addiction I was in. And I heard him, and I felt him, and I hadn't felt anything in a long time, and I hadn't understood anything I'd heard in a long time, but I knew if I could stop him before he left, I had a shot. And so before he left, I asked him, would you please talk to me? When I get out of here, can I talk to you? And I was used to being told no, because when you're homeless on the street, one of the things you learn to take well is no. So I really expected a no. But I didn't get that because I was in the presence of an AA who knew this power. And he said, it would be my honor to talk to you, which was a little bit shocking. He said, I'll tell you what, when you get ready to get out of here, just give me a call. Just call me when you get home and I'll come sit with you. And I was satisfied with that, and I started to sit down, and he turned around as he's walking out of the facility, and he goes, on second thought, you don't look too good. You better call me before you get out of here. And I did call him, and I hadn't taken a suggestion in a long time. And he came and sat with me that day. I'll tell you, the day before, I had gotten home, and I was sitting in the bathroom. My parents had allowed me to come stay with them for a little while just because they didn't know what the hell else to do with me. And I walked into the bathroom that morning before he was to come, and I looked in the medicine cabinet, and there was a bottle of cologne in there. And I stared at it for a long time, because if it hadn't had an atomizer on it, I'd have drank it. But I couldn't figure out how to hide the bottle. That's one of the things about us drunks. We're terrible. We can hide bottles everywhere till they're empty. I didn't know what the hell to do. Once I broke the neck off an atomizer, what the hell am I going to do to explain that? And a drunk like me, what the hell was I going to do with an ounce of cologne in it? But it doesn't have to make sense. Anyway, this guy took me through the steps directly out of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. He pointed out to me that was the title. He said, quit calling it the big book. You need to know this is a story of experience, not theories. This is, you're beyond theories, Joe. And he introduced me to this tangible power. I didn't really know what was going on, but he told me what we were going to go through, and he told me what that third step decision entailed. He told me that it wasn't about the prayer, and I was sure relieved to find out it wasn't about the prayer, because I'd said that prayer so many times, and people would say, well, Joe, you must not have turned it over when I came back. I don't know if any of you ever heard that. Yes. And I'm like, I thought I turned it over. How do you turn it over? You say, well, you just say the prayer. And I'm like, man, I said that damn prayer. But see, this power we come to believe in wants us to know, we want a relationship. And I didn't know all that, in spirit and in truth. I've since done some other studies and some other books, and I've found that you know, the time has come that we will worship in spirit and in truth. And AA says we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost self, and I've found that that's a very similar description of the same event. And I can tell you that when that power hit, I was never the same. I had to be chained up, locked up, or carried out every day, and then one day, bang! And I was never the same again, and it wasn't because of a man, it was because of a power. But he was a conduit of that power, and I know to this day what compels me when somebody says, will you come talk? That's all I want to do is tell that story about how I was in that scrap heap, and then I was raised. And then I started understanding the difference between therapeutic approaches and spiritual approaches to the AA program versus the fellowship and why people get confused. Because when they wrote our book, there was no medical diagnosis of alcoholism. So they weren't ever talking about a medical recovery. They were talking about a mining term, not a medical term, that to be redeemed, to be taken from a scrap heap and raised to a level of life better than the best we've ever known. And all I had to do was employ what I thought was a wasted life in something useful to help my brothers and sisters. And in that employment, I found that I had a new employer. I found that I had this tangible power, this presence on me that allowed me to go in. And I then could see, as I read those stories, I could see them completely different. When Bill talks about Ebby coming, I don't know, did any of you guys drinkers like really bad? I assume. I, as bad as it got for me, I always maintained someone who was just a little worse than me. Yep. That I could just say, at least I'm not that bad yet. And I look at Bill's story, and that's who Ebby is for him. Yes. Yeah, Ebby's that guy, at least I'm not that bad yet. And there's Ebby, it stone cold sober, and it can't be. It can't be. But what Bill noticed on him was that he was inexplicably different. And what Bill didn't know then that he later explains, and what I didn't know then but I later experienced, is that when Ebby walked in, it wasn't Ebby, it was the tangible presence of this power we call God, walked in the room. There was the miracle. And I thought, wow, that makes the whole story different. Again, the subject of my experience, not the object of my belief. I went through the steps that day with that man. I've had people since say, well, you can't go through the steps in a day. Well, of course you can. It's a manner of living. You just never stop. I got a list of people I had harmed, took an inventory, told the story. The man had to write for me because I couldn't write. I was shaking too bad. But he understood that, and I went through that process, and I learned a lot about me. And I learned a lot about other people, and I learned about this flow of the Spirit. I learned that it was real, and that it would continue to grow, and it would continue to protect and to manifest into where we find people 68 years later sharing this kind of a celebration, and it's happening all over the country and all over the world. And you think about, you know, some drunk in New York City I'm always amazed. On Thursdays we go through the story, and Bill talks about in his story that when Evie's talking to him, he says that real significance of that time in the cathedral burst upon me. And I've had so many moments of those kind of revelations, but I think about Bill's, he's getting ready to go to war, and he's frightened, and he stands in the graveyard, he sees the old soldier who survived war and drank himself to death. And then he's in New York, and he's an old soldier, and he's drinking himself to death, and he says the significance bursts upon me, and he starts talking about the washing of the Spirit he received, but the power that was with him before he went into World War I battle was with him now, and apparently it was a prophetic message for him then. And I've had such experiences in recovery that give me, as your theme here, you know, that this we've found much of heaven goes into that page 24. Steve was reciting it before the meeting. The absolute certainty that my Creator has entered my heart and lived. And to come from the place I came from, I was a doubter at best. And so, you know, that kind of certainty makes it a whole lot better, you know, for walking about. Anyway, that process of amends is an ongoing thing. I found out as I continued to grow in this thing that helping other people, taking them through their steps, doing the different things we do to try and help people grow, that is the big amends. And so I had to learn to go admit when I was wrong. I had to learn to go pay up. I had to do those things. All so that I wouldn't project my fear on the alcoholic who still suffers. I didn't realize, and then I realized how badly things had gone over years, and how I had missed the whole message. That, you know, when people came and just wished me well, then, you know, they were trying to honor these principles. You know, I didn't realize that I wasn't supposed to share my opinion of what people were doing. You know, and I started to grow in this thing, I realized that what I thought was uncaring was simply a love that sees beyond our role in the flesh. And it was good that it happened for me, because since that time I've gone through a lot of things. I've been abstinent to the extent that any of us really in the spirit are ever abstinent. I like to tell the new people, guys, if you can still bring to consciousness that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks and you're sitting here sober, then we better introduce you to tangible power. And the fellowship may not produce that for you. But this program of recovery won't produce it, but it'll raise your awareness of it. And to the extent you discipline your thoughts and what have you, you will find that we do get, as the author said, a sense of power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowing into us. So what I always point out to them is what we really seek here in the program of recovery is spiritual inebriation, not abstinence. I'm not any good at abstinence. And people think I'm crazy until we get to talking and we start getting washed with the Spirit. And anyone that's ever sat down with anybody and started talking about the Spirit comes on and we get washed with the Spirit. And pretty soon, we're lit up. And if you haven't had that experience, grab someone who's sitting here nodding, because no sense in cheating yourself out of it. It's free hookup. You know what I mean? We found the great reality deep within us. In the last analysis, it's only there it can be found. We've got to go in. The answers for you are in you. So what do I come to share? I come to share that good news. In every AA meeting I've ever been in, there was three distinct groups of people. People in their first 30 days, people in their last 30 days, and a whole bunch of people in the middle. And I know that because I've been in all three groups. And I will tell you, you don't always know you're in that middle one until you're a little too late. So what I have done now, instead of listening to some of the people that don't pay attention, I've come to really revere this consciousness of presence that we can develop through thought life. And I do a lot of things. I started going to church services because my book said go be quick to see where religious people are right. Didn't say that they were, just said be quick to see where they're right. Which meant I don't have to agree with them, but I might want to read their book, given that our book came largely from theirs. And I look in there and they, They tell me, as I start looking at the fifth and sixth, seventh step, they tell me, faith without works is dead, and how appallingly true for an alcoholic. And you may not know it if you don't get it, but if I'm a doubter by nature. So if I don't prove this power to me, through me, it isn't real. And it doesn't matter how real it is for you if it isn't real for me. So, you know, I'm the guy that has to make it home, right? And I went home lots of times after a meeting. I wasn't picking up no matter what. And somewhere in the way home, I presumed I'd overreacted. There wasn't a soul there. So, you know, it better be a power greater than me. It better be operating in me and through me. And it better be tangible, and it better be relevant, right? So, I don't know, you know, I don't know what the end game is. I just don't look so seriously for the end game anymore. It's interesting to me that I got a book that says if we expect to live long or happily in this world, and we need to develop this relationship. And I don't really much care about long anymore. I'm really just pleased with happily. And I start to understand that vision that our authors point out, you know. See to it your relationship with him is right, and great things will come to pass for you and countless others. And you, man, think about the story of, you know, I sell cars for a living. I don't have an opportunity to do good turns for people all the time. So when somebody can tell me that not only have they got introduced to power, that this power changed their life, will you come talk to us, and they'll come from another country, and I get to go do that and see that really happened to an old drunk like me. That really happened for an old drunk like me, and then I realized, Joe, that didn't happen for you. That happened for him and for them and for everyone else that may be benefiting from it. You lost your right to claim credit if you ever had one. And the fact is, it makes it so much easier to go do any of this stuff when you don't have to. And you know what else got easier? Is I can go sell cars without taking that personally. And you don't think car guys know God? I meet so many of them. I had a guy not too long ago. He calls me from the parking lot. Now, you got to understand, I'm in a fleet office. And I've got an office by myself, not with the rest of the people in the fleet department. So I almost never get a phone call from the outside. But this one was insistent. It's ringing on my phone. So I finally answered the damn thing. I don't answer them very often because it's usually some service question and I got to get up off my rump and go do something. So I'm sitting there quietly and I answer the phone and the guy says, well, my wife and I have decided to buy a car. And I said, well, I sell cars. I'd be happy to help. I said, when can you come in? He says, well, I'm in the parking lot. I said, you're in the parking lot? And he says, yep, God told me just to dial the number, see who answered, and see how it turned out. That's what he said to me. So I walked out because I now knew, believe it or not believe it, but that stuff never happened to me before I started knowing what was really happening for me. I went out and I sold this guy and his wife, their first new car ever. And as we're sitting there, around the Phoenix area, people have been coming to this meeting I do called the Position of Neutrality for years, and we try and show them the big book, bring it alive for them. And this guy had just come up out of a few years before, come up through the mission, and he was still struggling a little bit. He had been closer to the church and not to the recovery communities. Anyway, he says, I could just use a little recovery talk, perhaps. And I don't even know why he was sharing that with me other than, I mean, it's not like we look like it when we're out. I mean, we think we do. But anyway, I just played some recordings for him while he sat there and did his paperwork. And so it was amazing to have that kind of experience. And I have those kinds of experiences all the time. There's promises in the third step that you know, they tell me I have a new employer. And being all powerful, he provides what I need if I keep close to him and perform his work well. And I found it means all kinds of things. I was driving, and I had an old beat up car at one time. I was driving across Phoenix, middle of the summer. Again, it's hotter than hell there. It's a little hotter than it is here, I think, most days. And I had a tire going out, but I thought it was a bearing, and I didn't have enough money to pay for it. This is all in sobriety. I was learning those promises of, you know, outgrowing fear of economic insecurity. If you people have never been told, we outgrow economic insecurity or the fear of it by walking through it. And I have to learn to walk through it sober. So if that's happening for you, please know it's happening for you, not to you. It's a fact. You can't outgrow it if you don't experience it. And if I don't experience it consciously, I don't learn to depend. But anyway, what ended up happening was when I realized that the tire had gone out and not the bearing, I was relieved. And so I got out and I thought, well, it's hot, but I can at least, you know, I can get a tire from the tire shop and we'll be okay. Before I could get into the trunk of this car and discover I did not have a jack, a guy skidded alongside me, and I'm talking on a major thoroughfare, skids up alongside of me, and he says, "Sir, do you need a jack?" Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. Not only did he offer me one, he got out and he set the jack for me, and then he drove off. He says, "I got plenty. See ya." Who's that happened to? So these things are real, and you know, I continue to be amazed, and I don't know why I'm amazed. It doesn't even make any sense anymore. I find myself often in adversarial situations which would have had me acting adversarial, and I don't feel a need to respond anymore. The reason we call the meeting on Thursday night the position of neutrality is because for people of a scientific mind to realize that for those of us that are conscious of presence, that the laws of physics are suspended for us. That we think about what those authors are saying, and that we feel that we've been placed in a position of neutrality. But at my cellular level, I am nothing but a swirling mass of electrons whirling around precise laws, action and reaction. But to be placed above that, above natural law, so that I don't have to, that I can know peace, the absence of conflict, even in great turmoil. I sought that in drinking and other things. And I think there were probably some points at which I may have achieved it. Or alcohol, the essence of what was, achieved it for me. But the fact that that can be done in a non-synthetic way, simply because I've made a decision to accept this gift of grace and offer it to others. And the condition of being an instrument of grace, if you haven't been told, is that you give up your right to be offended about what other people say or do. I can't have the experience of grace if I'm not an instrument of grace. And instruments don't criticize. They just do what they're pointed at. And that's not something that humans do. You know, that it's completely contrary to our nature. Some of us are better natured than others, but I'm not. But I am amazed that we get this freedom. You know, that ninth step promise. You're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. And I had no idea that little prayer I a little understood, the first half of that commitment prayer, that third step portion where I'm going to give him the credit if he'll just take away my difficulties. I didn't know my difficulties were hopelessness and dishonesty and resentment and fear. I thought they were court charges and ex-wives and, you know what I mean? But I was empowered to walk through all that stuff so that my hopelessness and my selfishness and my dishonesty and my fear, my resentment, my jealousy, my bitterness was at least reduced to a point I could live in this flesh. And as a result of that, then I can go out as an instrument and I can still be useful and I didn't have to achieve perfection. I always like to point out that, you know, as we show people our book, we need to point out they learned everything in that book by making mistakes. And this book isn't a book on how any of y'all ought to behave. It's a book on how if I will try and behave, it won't matter to me how you behave. Right. And that's a really neat trick for an addict of the hopeless variety, an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. Learn that I can find ease and comfort in the world without going out in the world to get it. Because I'm always searching for ease and comfort, and my senses lie and tell me it's out there. But there is this new sense, this new power that I have come to know. I I don't ever really know where it's taking me. I have a sense now that there's a new direction coming. I'm not terribly thrilled with being a car guy, but I quit fighting. I finally had a guy who said, I goes, you know, I've done everything I could possibly do. I'm tired of being in the car business. When can I do something else? And he looks at me, he goes, when you're not looking to do something else. When you're okay to stay, you'll be okay to go. I thought, boy, that pisses me off. I'd rather not hear that. You know what I mean? But I think it's true. I think that I had to learn that God's will really has no opposite. And the idea that I have a will apart from all that is pure delusion. And that if I will, number one, acknowledge that there is a power and that that power does direct, and that if I'll get on board with the direction, typically what I find I'm struggling with is the very thing I prayed for yesterday. And I didn't know it. And I find that to be true more and more. I have learned as a result of an ability to fellowship, a new manner of living, and an entire worldview that has been just completely reshaped because of this power, I have learned that it is quite possible to exist harmoniously with most people. And more importantly for me and for most people, I'm able to live harmoniously with me. Because one of the things I discovered is that the world doesn't cause how I think and feel anyway. The world simply reflects to me how I'm thinking and feeling. And once I know that little trick, once I quit fighting with that idea, I've projected my perspective onto the moment. It's not going to change till my perspective changes. It doesn't matter how wrong it might be. If I don't see my value as an instrument of grace in every single situation, I cannot grow through that situation, and it won't be removed. I'll get a new teacher. So what I have learned is that I've got no reason to be afraid, although I often am. I don't have a need for you to like me, but I hope you do. And that if I will continue to do the things I've been doing, reaching out to others, bearing witness as I agreed to, then the likelihood is I will continue to grow in this new freedom and this new happiness. And I did finally learn what that new freedom was. I asked once upon a time that this power relieved me of the bondage itself. And what I didn't really understand at the time, but I was just trying to get free of me so I was free to be me. And I am free of me to a large extent today, and I suffer much less in my thought life as a result. And I am deeply grateful and appreciative of you letting me come share this story with you. I'm going to get out of here because I can see the clock says it's time. Thank you very much.